This is a podcast from the Shooting People DCTV Masterclass Series, held in New York City each month. Here, Jamie Boylan talks to Amy Sewell, producer of the hit documentary Mad Hot Ballroom, and author of The Mad Hot Adventures of an Unlikely Documentary Filmmaker.
So in 2003, you're a stay-at-home mom, yeah, in the spring, writing for the Tribeca Trib, your little
old right now.
Local paper. We didn't say ages, we just said stay-at-home mom.
4 years ago, all right, yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so 2003, stay-at-home mom, you're writing articles for the local paper, and they say, hey, would you like to write an article about this ballroom dance class happening at the local elementary school for fifth graders? And you say, sure.
I say yes, and he says, it's 10 cents a word, and I go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm starting over in journalism like this. And I took the job. I walked in to be a good reporter and take notes to write the article, and I started to write and write and write. I had to put down my pen because when I saw these kids, I thought, wow, and I really did. I thought, this would make a great movie. And I hadn't even seen really the arc to the story yet or written the article, but just the fact that it was a contrast from the beginning that there were kids doing something completely foreign to them, and their parents don't even ballroom dance, so it was kind of like, and they weren't, you know, frou-frou, like, ballroom dancing cotillions or whatever goes on out there in that world. So I thought, wow, this would make a great movie. And, you know, a moment, an idea comes and then it kind of goes. And I started taking my notes and I wrote 50,000 words for this article that then had to be a 3,500-word article that then had to be a 1,500-word article. And I think when I knew I had the content there with the writing of the 50,000 words, that it, there was something there. And I thought, I'm going to make a movie. And my husband's a coach, a basketball coach, high school, and teacher. And I said to him in July, I had been thinking about it for a while, and the article was published in July. I said, I'm going to, honey, I'm going to make a documentary. And he said, you go, babe. And I thought, great, that's all the support I need. Another blind idiot to support me, so.
And the thing is, you'd never made a film. So just to give everybody a sense of the timeline, and there's an amazing, like, very detailed timeline of every single step in the back of the book. But this was July. You really decided to make the film, right?
Right.
By the next January, you were in production. You had a crew. You had tons of research. We're going to go backwards and sort of talk in detail about these things. But just to give everybody a sense, January of that next spring, you were in production.
Yep.
You filmed for 4 months, watched the whole semester.
Yep.
And then by the next January, you didn't get into Sundance. You got into Slam Dance.
Yep.
The Los Angeles Times critic said the best movie, the movie to see at Sundance this year isn't at Sundance. It's at Slam Dance. It's Mad Hot Ballroom. And the movie sold to Paramount.
Yes.
Immediately. So within a year and a half from, you know, sitting down and writing this article, you've got a movie sold to Paramount, which went on to become one of the top 10 grossing documentaries of all time. So where I want to start is I want to have you do, this is the reading. This is the reading portion.
Everybody gets to find out they can't read very well. Okay.
This moment when you're at Slam Dance and you sort of really realize what you've got on your hands. I want to start at the end and then go back to the beginning because I loved this story. So you and Marilyn, the director, are at Slam Dance with your film, and you've had two screenings for the public. You've been promoting the hell out of it all over town, and you sneak away to a bar just to have a moment to yourselves. And
we did. We went to one of these kind of hole-in-the-wall bars because we thought, well, nobody will be there, and we can kind of just get away. And I want to say that we were out stapling posters. We had our feet on the ground doing all the legwork, which is what you do. You're out there selling. And as I said in the book earlier, all I really wanted to do was go to all these film festivals because I'd been home with twins for like 4 years, and I just wanted to go out and party. And after the first festival, I thought, oh, my God, if I have to do this all year, I'm going to die. Not that I'm not a hard worker. I am. But it's like, okay, wow. Everything's kind of a wake-up call. So we took off, and so I'll just start reading. Marilyn and I had some of our own fun experiences, too. We went to an out-of-the-way hole-in-the-wall to have a beer with the acquisitions people from Focus Features. Actually, we wanted to get away. This was set up by our agent just to have a nice beer. We thought, okay, well, that's what we'll do. All right. It made me realize that all the really important people, the deal makers, hung out at the normal places where no glam-seeking filmmaker or festival groupies would ever set foot in. While we were sitting there having a beer with the Focus people, we looked across the room. There were the guys from Roadside Attractions, distributor of Super Size Me. When the Focus people left, the Roadside people walked up to us, leaned in, and said, "Ladies, you are the belles of the ball. Don't sell that movie too soon." And we giggled like five-year-olds, like five-year-old schoolgirls having no idea what was in store for us. You have to remember, we were all just kind of normal people thrown into a once-in-a-lifetime experience. This was not something any of us expected, not something any of us thought would ever happen. It was a lot like winning a big prize in the lottery. Even though Marilyn had been working in the industry for years, this catapulting with our movie to the plane of being on distributors and studio executives' radar was even a long shot for her. And for me, come on, get out of town. We were basically swept off our feet. The belles of the ball were really happy with their dance card. There was a united communal camaraderie and an injection of hope and inspiration to others that this too could happen to them, since it was just happening to us and we were so normal. And we were really normal, and we still are normal. That's what is bizarre about the whole thing. So
you are normal, but I think the reason that she's a very normal sane human being, but I think that the reason that I was so struck by that is that you're also very humble, and I think, I'm not sure if you realize, you must to some extent, what set this film apart. And I think, you know, a lot of people would have gone into the Tribeca classroom and seen these kids dancing, said that's a great idea for a movie, and immediately picked up a camera and started working. And we've talked about this, that I think the thing that sets Mad Hot Ballroom apart, and you are inspired by the story, it's an amazing story, but what sets you apart and what you really did was you did your homework, you did your research, you did the hard work every day. And I sort of want to talk about what that process was like from the beginning. Once you decided to make the film, there were three things I think you tackled in a really big way that a lot of people skim over or rush through because they want to get to the exciting part of making the film. But one was researching your topic. I mean, you knew this topic, ballroom dancing inside and out. Films that had been made about ballroom dancing. Like, you watched and studied and did everything. Then filmmaking, because you weren't a filmmaker.
Right.
How did you tackle that? And then there's this other side of you that I think is really key to your success, which is that you have this background in marketing and business, and you approached it, you know, sort of a project management, how do I tackle this? What's the market for a film? So what was, when you decided to make a film and your husband said, "Go, honey, even though you know nothing about it, let's do it," where do you start and how did you tackle that?
All right. First, I have to kind of differentiate two kinds of filmmakers, because I'm not going to put myself in the other class, and I would never be, you know, that presumptuous to do so. I kind of consider myself a storyteller or journalist. I'm by nature curious, and I want to know why so-and-so's doing that. Like, I was just doing a photo shoot for something else a week ago, still photos, and I noticed the father at some point took his crucifix, and tucked it in his shirt. And I thought, who is he talking to, and why did he do it just at that moment? I'm always watching to see, why did somebody do that just then? So that, by nature, I think, we'll just put, you know, to make it easy, is the journalism category. I have no interest, and I cannot even know what it would be like to direct, like, actors and make films, narratives, etc. And I think it's daunting. I don't want to have any more than one truck ever and one light. And, you know, I think there are two films. Those are those who want to really make art and be filmmakers, and that's this group, and I can't speak to that group. So if you're in that group, I can't go there, and I would never be that way to go there. As far as, you know, running out and sticking on shoes to make a documentary, absolutely. And I think you can do it, but 99% of documentaries are not successful, so I don't want you to get, you know, seduced into thinking that, you know, a lot, I have to always back up from Jamie or other people and say, you know, yeah, we did our homework, and we went out, and we hit the pavement, and we got lucky. We got lucky. Our team won, which we didn't know would win, which made it the all-American underdog story, which is what Americans love. And, you know, it didn't play as well in Europe, okay? Because Europe, they want all those scenes that, you know, it's different. They want the art, too. So, you know, we got lucky. And so I have to say that, too. But you definitely have to do your homework. What happened after I said I was going to make it is I sat in Barnes & Noble for 2 days, and I pulled all the books off the shelves of filmmaking books, and I found seven in each stage of filmmaking that I liked, and I read them. And they're in the back of the book. So I read those books, and then I sat down, and I kind of went backwards. It was so ridiculous looking back, and I love Maryland because we laugh about these things all the time. The very first thing is I made a list of all the film festivals I wanted to go to. And she's like going, oh my God, like how am I ever going to deal with me? And then the second thing I did was I wrote an action plan. And this is like a business plan. What do I think I have to do first? Well, besides make the movie, what do you have to do before that? And that's all in here too. So, and then the third thing that we did is, and which all of you should do, which we were just talking about tonight, I love movies. I haven't seen movies like I used to see movies before I started making movies. And you watch them and you think about things you love in certain movies and certain shots without even having the language of knowing, I love that movie because it said this or I felt this. To me, it's more about the feeling. And, you know, you go back and look at movies you loved and what you loved about them. But I remember when I told my husband that the next day he took the kids somewhere and it's not really a nap, but I meditate and I thought, well, how do I see this movie unfolding? Like, what would I want to see if I saw this movie? And I wrote an outline. And that's where I think the writing comes in with documentary filmmaking. And that's why I took writer credit. And it's like, it's the most stupid thing you could do because it's always the question, how do you write a documentary? And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to answer that question all the time. But it comes with the outline. And the outline was then later turned into a treatment, which is more detailed shots. And even if you don't follow it, it gives you something to veer from because it's something that you'll go back to as kind of the master blueprint and say, well, this doesn't work or this works, because here's the other reason you write an outline. You just can't go out and shoot forever. It costs money. Your DP is costing you every day. Your sound person, if that's all you have, you're still, and you're feeding them, and then you're buying mini DV stock, and you bought the whatever. You have to have boundaries on the giant net that you're going to throw out there. And you can throw a giant net, and you can have 18 million different categories. History of ballroom dancing, the program, the dance teachers, the kids, the principals, their communities. You can keep pulling down the threads of the giant net. And eventually, as you start to shoot and as you bring in amazing people, which I also want to say, you can't do this alone and you shouldn't do it alone. Marilyn was amazing as the director. And Sabina, you know, when I looked at this, I thought, God, editors are gold. They really are the core to filmmaking, and certainly sounds important too, and that's as big as our crew. And shooting, my God, Claudia, you know, beautiful scenes and portraits painted with the camera. So you put all that together and you hope that, you know, nothing too horrible goes wrong and you set off on your journey. But that outline has what you imagine to be the arc. And I think this was simpler now that I'm in a new documentary. Because this had an arc, it was a competition. You were going to, and I'd written the article, so I'd already starting to see where the kids at some point rise to the occasion, what they get out of it, and where they go. Even though I followed one team, but I love that outline, and I go back to it because even though it was like Marilyn, I laughed. So there were some silly things I wanted to insert and stuff. It pretty much followed right on cue to all the way to the point. And this is how I write outlines now. It's very simple. At some point in a movie, when you watch other people's movies, you go, yeah, but where is she from? Boom. That filmmaker should take you, at least if, you know, if there is kind of like a mass way of thinking, general, that filmmaker should take you to that person's home. Because at that point, you're going, wait a minute. Well, how come she thinks like this? Where is she from? Wherever the questions come up, it's the outline. So at some point in this movie, I was like, well, what's up with last year's winners, the school? And that's exactly when you need to go to last year's winners. And you can see when the little girls get worried if you saw the movie. Yeah, but last year there was that school from Queens. Boom, you go to Queens. So here's another thing I think about outlines. Keep them simple, even if your story is complex. This is a writer, when I write my articles or my columns and stuff, we overcomplicate things. Keep it simple. Sometimes it's just one thing about a character, and that's all it needs to be. And the audience will take that and run with it, and they'll look around her room and see what's behind her, or they'll look at her community. And like Jamie said, they'll fill in the blanks. You get that. They don't need to be told or hit over the head. And on this new documentary I'm doing, I wrote an outline, and I keep thinking, keep it simple, keep it simple. You know, stories are simple. So went from the outline to doing all the research at the Performing Arts Library and watching way too many dance instructional videos and things, and, you know, really thinking that it was more about the program. And when we started to film and we had did all the adult interviews and we had 150 hours worth of footage, when the kids started to speak, the adults fell away, and here came this story. And this is where I believe in, like, you know, I don't really believe in a God, but, you know, some kind of movement. Because if you're out to tell a story and you've chomped onto something and you think it needs to be told, you put those blinders on and you take a leap of faith and you trust that if you're interested in the story, there's a story to be told. Make the movie you want to see and forget about what the distributors, the industry people want to see, or the guy that you go out to dinner with every Friday night who espouses everything and knows it all and this is what you should do, and you're like, ugh, you know? Boring. You make the movie you want to see, and I guarantee you there will be a following of people who also want to see it. And I think we forget that quickly, and because everything else kind of seeps in people's opinions and this and that. So you read the books, you do your research, and you do the outline, and then you start to film. And you follow, you know, there's somewhere in here there's like 33 things to do on a film day, from beginning to end, from charging the batteries to getting up to packing
ice,
you know? You just have to remember Band-Aids and this and that, because something will screw you up out there. Somebody will get cut, and you won't be near a Duane Reade. And you'll need a Band-Aid, you know? And it's like, ah! You know, and somebody's just about to say something great, and somebody's bleeding to death, right? All right, so...
Anyway. You actually covered a lot of the... you sort of touched on a lot of the things that I wanted to talk about. First of all, you know, that you did this tremendous amount of scouting beforehand, which I would love for you to talk about in a second. You know, how you picked the schools, how you picked the kids, how you picked who you were going to follow. But then there was also this process of listening to your editor saying, this is actually what's playing in the edit room, not necessarily what you're filming. It's not the adults, it's the kids, it's all of these things. And, you know, also in the book you talk about planning to shoot at the schools a lot more and realizing you had enough, so then readjusting for that.
And the team Marilyn put together, she had years and years in the industry, and she knew, you know, who to bring on board and would tell me about it, we'd talk about it. You know, it was so much a collaboration in so many ways. In fact, you can have someone with the idea and the drive and the passion, and I really kind of, I'll give that to myself as the coach and get everyone up and out there and whatever and leaping, because you really, you have to get out there and you have to spend 9 hours in a park waiting for that one great line that you finally get and that they say. But once, you know, and the outline was there as a giant umbrella, but Sabina really started to see it in the editing room, what cut, what wouldn't cut, you know, and how it could be put together. That coming down the pipeline, the kids speaking. And, you know, one of the things of work, I always say work with somebody else, because you work in a vacuum by yourself. You think it's right, but...
What is that core team that you need to have when you're really thinking about a release, a film that you want to go somewhere, and how do you pick them?
I think as the head coach that paranoia is a great asset. Like, you have to think, okay, what's going to go wrong? What could go wrong? I'm by nature paranoid all the time, and it's not healthy, but it's me. And we did get a lawyer on board, because I was thinking, well, what are we going to encounter? Well, releases. You have to get a release on everybody. Don't think you're going to go back and find that person or that kid, or later on when it happens, that parent's going to sign that release for that kid. Every time it was a major interview, or not even a major, somebody was on camera for longer than 10 seconds, we got a release on them. We had 700 release forms. The lawyer would tell us what we could and couldn't film. You can't film illegal activity. There's stuff going on Washington Heights that you couldn't film. You know, just a lot of things. Music, okay? That cell phone ring in Brooklyn was $10,000 until I wore them down to $2,500 for 6 seconds of the Rocky song, Bill Conti. You know, people don't give that stuff away for free. When the music industry says, play a note, pay for it, they'll make you pay for it. And if you try and slide by and go to festivals, they're at those festivals. They see that there's a song in there, and they will find you later. And you know what? Because you didn't do it the right way the first time, they're not nice. They're just not nice or easy to deal with. So, and it's all in here. You know, there's a lot of just things to, and on copyright and clearance, know your laws. They're out there. It's bizarre. They're everywhere. I mean, when the kids, PS 112 plays in the orchestra, we kind of wanted to show everyone that Well, they tried everything. They're not good at everything. They tried everything, though. So they're playing some song. And can you believe that what came back and bit us in the ass later is, so, I can't even believe they recognize the damn song. I can't recognize it. But there's a publishing outfit in San Diego, and they saw the movie, and the lawyer called and wanted $20,000. And the lawyer later said, are you joking? Frank Sinatra's people didn't get $20,000, you know? And then they were talking Most Favored Nation. I'm like, no, I just forget it. They can sue me, and I'll love the extra press at that point. I mean, I was so mad because it's like this raking over the coals thing, and I thought that's ridiculous. But I said I would pay them, which we did, which was, you know, equal to something else in the film in the same length of time, which was like $1,000 or something like that. But they'll find it, and they'll come after you. And we've had other people do in festivals, and they came after them later. You know, you just have to cross your T's and dot your I's and watch it. And it's annoying. And it makes you, you know, less of a nice person, I think, at that time.
So how do you pick the people that get in the boat with
pick
you to
the
do
people.
That?
Yeah, well, you know, I have to give Marilyn all the credit for that because she knew and we would talk about it.
Yeah, but you're doing it now. I mean, we've been
right, we're doing
about,
it now. Claudia was a dancer before she became a filmmaker. She never went to film school. She picked up a camera and started volunteering at NYU Student Films to shoot stuff and then would go on sets and ask the director if she could shoot the B-roll or be a second or third or fourth camera, and she just started shooting. But what made her great for Mad Hot Ballroom is she knew how to move around the kids because she knew the dances. And so she could dance around them, which is an amazing... And you know what? She can dance around anybody on the street, too, whether it's a movie about dancing or not. I have her now on this film. The reason I went with her again is my own insecurities in a big way, speaking my language. I picked up 6 books on directing and read about shots and angles, and I was like... Blah. And so I'm able to say to Claudia, you know what I think is cool if they're like starting far away and coming up down the road and then this and this and this. And so she speaks my language, which is still not film student speak. So she knows what I'm thinking and we get in each other's heads. Tammy, I'm using again on sound because, you know, Tammy's amazing and she's right there with the boom or Mikey. You know, she gets it and she knows how to move around Claudia, because I've used other sound people and other camera people, and they get caught up in each other's cords and stuff. So now the sound person needs to know how to move with the camera person. And so I've stayed familiar grounds there. Editors, like I said, are amazing. They have to be the right person for the job. They have to know what you're trying to do and keep the tone. I think that they can be so much smarter and better than you as a filmmaker, or as a person, because they know how to cut and they know how to put it together and they get it. But I think it's about keeping the tone. If this tone starts to change, it becomes a runaway film and you lose your voice or your tone. It's just like writing an article. You got to keep your voice. And one of my big things is keeping humor. And I'm probably always going to keep humor in movies. I need to keep humor. I need to laugh. I need to laugh, so I think other people need to laugh. So whatever I do, even if it's heavy, I need some of those moments where people laugh and just to get it, just to breathe, you know, just to get a breather there. And then I think working with a co-director or co-producer or anything, it's about, you know, bouncing ideas off each other and basically getting on each other's heads and just living on each other like, I don't know, an octopus would grab a rock or something, and you're together all the time. And don't think you're always going to get along with people. That's like not, you're going to have fights. But I think the important thing about fighting is fighting constructive, like in a constructive way and being productive and then getting past it. And if you can't get past it, then you just have to rock, paper, scissors or flip a coin and lose one. You know what I mean? Somebody, if you're going to work with a partner, but I highly recommend working with somebody because it's really nice to talk to somebody about how insecure you are about what you're doing. It's kind of like therapy. All right.
And one of the other really unique things, you know, in addition to the research and all the business planning that you did ahead of time, is, you know, something you mentioned earlier, you're paying people. You have a limited amount of money. You have a limited amount of time. And when I looked at your, you know, your production sheet, like your shot lists and your plans for each day, it really looks more like, you know, the setups that I've had on a narrative film. You didn't waste a single minute. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to that strategy? Because I think it's really unusual in documentary film to go from literally what we would call a narrative setup to setup to setup all day so that you get a full day out of your crew.
You have to make a plan. You have to have a plan. You just can't go out and shoot. It doesn't happen like that. It's weird, which also now you can go into the whole philosophy of, well, is it really a documentary? Because if you're planning the day and then you're also editing it, well, you know, okay, well, that's a whole nother conversation. But, you know, if you have endless, I said today, this was one of my jokes today, we were in Washington Square Park, and I turned to Claudia as we're going around getting B-roll, and I go, why can't we just find somebody to pay us to document life for the rest of our lives, you know? Because it's so great to have that kind of space to shoot that B-roll, but you don't have that luxury. You have to get the content, you have to get the B-roll, you have to get all the cutaways, you have to, see, I'm speaking a better language even now. You know, there's so much you have to do. We put together a plan, and it's usually driven by budget. We had X amount of dollars. This was what we paid our DP. We paid our editor. We paid our sound person. These people have to put food on the table. And if it means you borrowing from the bank and going into debt, that's, guess what? That's going to be your burden because you decided to make a movie. And, you know, it's not their fault that you decided to make a movie. So they need to eat. And I think when you pay people, it makes them feel good. You get a full day's work. And I'll tell you what else goes a long way. Feed them well. Don't make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches unless you absolutely have to. Feed your people. They're working hard and they're hungry. And give them a glass of wine or a beer at the end of the night. They need that too. So, and that's the mother in me, I think. But, you know, we plan 30 days out. And I think we shot 45. You're going to go over. So, and we planned 45 for this current doc, and we're going to be at 60. So I guess, you know, in the back of your mind, know you're going to go X percent over and plan for it. There's nothing wrong with spending money, okay? And I'm sick and tired of this world, and I hate capitalism and all that other crap. Go ask people who have money for money. If you're making a good movie for a good cause, damn it, you know, say, look, you could give this to charity or you could buy a share of my LLC. And if we fail, you know, you can form an LLC. It costs nothing. You can do it at midnight on New York State government. I think I list the websites in here. And you file for $120. You'll worry about the details later. You know, you eventually have to put an ad in a paper or something like that, but people are fighting that and that might change. You form an LLC and you sell shares. Let's say your movie's going to cost $500,000. You'll sell 50 shares of $10,000 each. If it's a wash and you lose everybody's money, they get to write off 10 grand right off the top of their income taxes. It's an ordinary income loss, which is kind of a good thing if it's a loss. It means that if they make 100 grand a year, they get to say they only made 90 grand a year. All right? So they're not really losing that much, and then they get to write off things against it. All right. If it's breaks even, fine, you paid them back their money plus 15%. It's all in here how we did that. You know, they get a little bonus. That's their rate of return is the 15%. If there's anything to be made over and above that, they get that. And yes, the downfall is they're going to pay ordinary income on a profit, which is not the best thing. It'd be better if it was like a capital gain. But even then, there you've got rules where you can only, you know, do with losses, 3,000, gains, this, blah, blah. You know what? Most of these people are given to charities, and they're getting a 30% write-off. If they lose all their money, they'll get the same basic percentage in an ordinary income loss on their income taxes, and they're employing a crew for a year or longer, and they're putting people to work about an important topic. And that's the way you should sell it, and you should just believe in it that way. And find people, when you go to troll for funders, people tend to donate in the same areas. You know, they don't really go across the board. My husband and I are into giving to things that expose kids to things, like the Fresh Air Fund and this and that. So if you're doing a documentary on, I don't know, throw something out there, you know, something in Africa, look for other fundraisers where you've got the list of the people and the firms and whatever that have already donated to that. They'll usually give to the same areas. If it's about animals, elephants, penguins, something. You know, it's hit up Sierra Club and other things. People tend to donate to the same subjects. Go after them. They'll be happy to give, you know, to save another dog's life or something like that. You know what I mean? So that's, you know, kind of with the funding. Back to the lawyers and picking out people like that. Make sure you find somebody who's going to do the job that you want them to do. If you don't find a lawyer that's going to fight for you, you're going to end up fighting for yourself. They're getting paid to fight for you. invite, you know, or if you're into like making everything fine, make sure you get a lawyer who's a great negotiator, who's going to make everything fine. It's a lot about personality matches, and it all comes down to this. It's very simple, and we all know this, but we never follow it, and I don't follow it either. Still, it's that gut feeling that you get. Usually something tells you that's wrong in your stomach, and you walk away. Well, it's okay. I'll just give her another month, or that's okay. I'll just do this for 2 more weeks. No, no, no. Cut bait. Be brave and say, this isn't working out. I'm very sorry. And find another person who does it right. You are only lying to yourself the same way the guy on the golf course is playing with a con artist and he's getting ripped off his whole life savings because he believes the guy is doing him good. I mean, people innately want to think that other people are doing them good or whatever. I mean, I'll get off this, but the minute your stomach turns, it's your intuition, follow it. You will know this because you will not be able to sleep. You will be going home with this problem in your head night after night after night. You know, one of the things my new producing partner does that's great, and I found it, she's an amazing enforcer. She just, boom, we can't do this, you're done, I'll send you a check at the end of the day. You know, and I have a hard time doing that, but I'm learning from her and I'm becoming better at doing it. You know, it's not that you're being mean to people. You have a job to do, you have to get it done. And if you love your project enough, if that project becomes your baby, you will be amazed at how quickly you'll stop the car from running over your kid. You know what I mean? It's really weird. But yeah, you should you should treat it like that because you're just pouring money into that baby. And at some point, you've got to make a movie. So it's amazing how quickly, you know, that comes up. All right, where am I now? I got lost.
My question pertains to editing and the story as well. What was the workflow between you and the editor to find the story, and who finds the story, or how do you find it together?
Well, so we would drop off we'd actually copy the tape so that you have a second set, and then she'd take all the footage in, you'd store the other footage so that you always had the originals and you weren't using them too much and wearing them down, and you start to put these things into buckets. But again, if you have an outline, you're going to see that you're going to have these buckets. But where this, what became interesting, and this is what happens to everyone when they see movies, if you see a movie that you don't completely like, you think, God, I wish they would have done this. This would have been interesting too. I wish I would have seen that. I'm curious to what the women in that film were doing, why the guys were doing that. You know, you have these natural questions. And I think a great editor, what you're interested in. And Sabina started saying, you know what, the adults are boring me. The kids are great. I love what they say. Get more, you know, find out what else the kids are thinking. She totally drove that process. I can't take any credit for that. I can take credit for getting everyone up and out and shooting, because it's a scary thing to wake up and get out there and get in people's homes and sit in their kitchens and go, hi. You know, it's a bizarre thing. You have to have, like, guts to do that. But totally, they see it. But that outline also helps you. With this current film we're doing, it's a giant net. It's a giant net, and you start to think, wow, that's more interesting than that. And that's totally more interesting than that. And then you start to pull it down. But we started editing on this one early, too, because it says something. I can't explain it. You know, you'll know. You'll see it because it'll interest you. But where does that go? It's a constant tug of war. Sometimes you're right. Sometimes the editor's right. Sometimes the person across the room who's your assistant editor who's been doing nothing but going out to get lunch and says something and you go, oh my God, she's right, or he's right. You know what I mean? It's weird. It's just a constant, it's a verbal ping pong. You're molding, you're sculpting, and nobody's idea is better than the other one, and nobody knows everything, and everybody knows everything.
Hi, this is not a sexy question.
Okay.
This has to do with budget. Tell us how the budget functioned from inception to completion.
In the beginning, Marilyn, I don't know if this ended up in the book. Our budget was $40,000. And then we started adding things. And as a businesswoman, I kept saying to Marilyn, give me your blue sky. Give me if you could make this film and get everything you wanted. You can't ask people for money twice, only once. They'll think you won't know what you're doing if you ask for money twice. So you have to have. So we built it up to the blue sky budget, but we followed other budgets. You ask other filmmakers for their budgets, and you know what? You give them, you get them, and you look at them, because your film is going to be a lot like Spellbound. So what did I do? I tracked down Jeffrey Blitz. I found out he dated one of my husband's cousins. You know, you find the person and ask them what their budget was, and you break it out percent-wise. Where'd you spend the most money? What'd you do here? What'd you do there? You can break down budgets percent-wise. A lot, you know, a lot goes into editing, and as it should, I think. It really should. And I know Heidi and Rachel, who did Jesus Camp and the Boys of Baraka, they love sound, you know, maybe more than visual. I don't know. What are you willing to forgive? As a viewer, as a mass brow viewer, I can forgive a cloudy shot. You know what I mean? To me, it's okay. I'll look harder. You watch HBO shows, and my husband and I are determined. We know that that they do it on purpose, that you can't understand everything they're saying, that you have to go back and watch it again because you have to see exactly what they were saying. You know what I mean? So sometimes sound isn't that. You know, the eye will get it all. So the budget just grew and grew and grew. But by the time you're ready to ask people for money, you better have a pretty solid budget because you can't go back twice.
Thank you, Amy Sewell.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you for coming.